Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Even if you've never gathered around a pay-per-view screen for WrestleMania, there's a good chance you recognize this voice.
Let me say it out loud, and let me point to the president of the World Wrestling Federation. The Macho Man Randy Savage is not happy with your decision, yeah. I am the cream in the World Wrestling Federation.
The late Macho Man Randy Savage was one of the biggest names in wrestling in the 80s and 90s, and one of its first breakout stars. His ascendance continued a family tradition and helped pro wrestling grow from a regional curiosity to the point where people like John Cena and The Rock are top Hollywood talent. Well, now there's a new biography of the man born Randy Poffo called Macho Man, The Untamed, Unbelievable Life of Randy Savage by my guest John Finkel. And Finkel joins us now. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So let's go back to the beginning. Tell us about Randy Savage's upbringing and how he sort of went from Randy Poffo to the Macho Man.
Yeah, he had a very different upbringing than anyone whose father was not a professional wrestler. Basically, he, from talking about grade school era, you know, Randy Savage and Randy Poffo and Lanny Poffo, his brother, who also became, you know, Leapin' Lanny Poffo and the genius in the WWE. Whereas a lot of people's dads got up and either put on a suit and tie or a blue collar shirt or whatever they did to go to their jobs in the, you know, in the 50s and 60s when their kids were in grade school. Randy and Lanny's dad was a professional wrestler. He was traveling on nights and weekends. He was home most of the time during the day once they were, once they had their activities, baseball, whatever sports they were playing. And Angelo Poffo was for the Midwest territories where they grew up in Chicago, or Downers Grove, just outside of Chicago. Their dad was a heel, so they had to get used to their dad getting, you know, imagine going to get groceries with your dad when you're six and people boo him, you know, when he's picking out bananas, right? And they come to your Little League game and parents are kind of, leery of who he is. And he was a very bombastic guy as far as how he looked. He had slick blonde hair. He often wore just Speedos around town, no shirt a lot. And so that was Randy and Lanny's dad growing up, the number one influence they had.
They were really ahead of their time in terms of focusing on fitness and healthy eating and that kind of thing. What role did that play in his development?
Yeah, a huge role. I think, you know, Randy grew up in a house that prioritized not only, having a drive, but having, you know, a focus on physical fitness. They were like the first house in the neighborhood to have a juicer. They were the first house in the neighborhood to have like weights in the basement. His friends used to come over and it was like the fun house. They had a pool out back. They had weights downstairs. They had a pool table. They had a mini wrestling ring in the basement. Like, this was the cool house for them and all their friends. And at the time, even though Angelo was a well-known wrestler and the family, you know, the kids were used to taking weekend road trips with their dad to, you know, all around the Midwest, whatever cities they could find, wherever they would be performing. When they got home, the kids had their own interests. And in this case, you know, Randy grew up a diehard baseball fan, and that was his number one dream, was to play Major League Baseball.
Yeah, and it might surprise some people to learn that he got pretty far toward that goal. He was ultimately a, you know, semi-successful minor league player, definitely held his own. How come baseball didn't work out ultimately?
Yeah, he came as close as you can. You know, his cup of coffee in the big time. Yeah, that was him. I mean, he never had the cup of coffee in the actual major leagues. He was really, really good. He was in high school at Downers Grove. He was exceptional. He hit 500 his junior year, 500 his senior year, despite learning to become a switch hitter in the offseason. So he didn't have any drop off in batting average, learning to hit from the other side of the plate. He hit for average. He hit for power. Everybody I interviewed who knew him as Randy Poffo walking around the high school hallways in Downers Grove, he was a surefire Major League Baseball player. His coaches said so. His teammates said so. This is a kid who walked throughout his high school with two bags, a backpack and a bag with his baseball bats in it. And he would sit in the back of class with a weighted metal ball And while the teacher was teaching, he wasn't goofing off or passing notes. He was doing tricep kickbacks and forearm exercises. He was completely and totally obsessed with playing Major League Baseball, to the point where they built a batting cage on the side of their house. Angelo and a bunch of neighborhood dads went out to the hardware store, bought all the stuff necessary, and built an actual 60-foot, 6-inch mound out there to prepare him for the majors. They bought a pitching machine. And so this was his whole entire life, baseball. He didn't get drafted, which was a shock to both him and his family and anyone who knew him. But then he managed to find a tryout. His dad drove him to a tryout for the Cardinals. And out of 300 people who tried out, he was the only person to make the team. And that's an incredible story in the book that people can read of how that happened. And then, yeah, he kicked around for 2-3 years, got cut a few times, had a couple hot streaks, and then just got super close. You know, a bunch of coaches who had him back then and managers who were still alive were saying, you know, if there was a major league of really, really good, he would have been in it. He just didn't have that last thing. He could hit, you know, when it came to the minors, he could hit for power, but not enough power. And he could hit for average, just not high enough average. And he could run the bases okay, just not fast enough. And none of the things were, you know, enough of a five-star talent to propel him to the major leagues.
And I want to talk about one aspect that applied to his training for baseball, but also later with the weight room and wrestling, which was he had kind of like a maniacal drive to be the best, no matter what he was doing. He didn't cut a lot of corners, it seems, and he forced himself, you know, to push and push and push. A lot of times, I think, you know, that goes back to people's upbringing if they have like a withholding, you know, coach, parent or whatever. But in this case, it doesn't seem like his dad, Angelo, was pushing him to follow in his footsteps necessarily. So where did all that drive come from?
Yeah, there were, I would say, like a Poffo family model was like, we don't cut corners, right, with like anything. They were a driven family. Angelo's claim to fame was breaking the world sit-up record when he was 20 years old in the Navy. And a ridiculous feat of over 4 hours of sit-ups to get to over 6,000 to break the world record. These were men, sort of men of action and men of accomplishment, and they were entertainers. And so that drive was certainly well within their world. Angelo's father, Randy and Lanny's grandfather, worked in front of a blast furnace every day after he came over from Italy. So these were not easygoing, like, you know, deliver milk, get an accountant job kind of guys back then. And so that's where that came from. And so when Randy's dream of being a Major League Baseball player died, he was shattered. And he didn't know where to turn or what to do. But we knew he wasn't going to go become, you know, an architect. And his brother had already had some success in wrestling. And his father obviously had a long time success. And after some little bit of soul searching, Randy woke up one day and was like, I'm going to be a wrestler. And to the earlier part of your question about that intensity and the drive, he turned every single ounce that he had put into when it came to being a professional baseball player, all that discipline, all the reps, all the swings, into becoming a pro wrestler. And in the beginning, in addition to learning, you know, how to wrestle and how to become a worker and all that, his actual quest was to pack on an enormous amount of mass, because he had spent the first 20 plus years of his life building a baseball body at 6 foot, 6'1", maybe 185 pounds. But in the ring, even against his brother, who was already, you know, near 6'2" and close to 240, he just was way, way too small. So he embarked on an absurd quest to put on like 50 pounds over the course of 2 years.
Yeah, he always felt a little undersized in that he had to stand out as best he could, right?
Yeah, it was, it's something that I grew up in like peak Macho Man years in the WWE back then, WWF, were my peak wrestling as a kid years, where I believed everything, right? So he was, you know, I was 7 or 8 at WrestleMania 3, and then obviously, you know, 9, 10, 11 through, you know, WrestleMania 4, 5, and 6, all the way up to 7 with Ultimate Warrior. I was still only 12, you know, so like I was all in believing all these things. So I didn't really think about it at the time, because what his illusion, his gimmick worked. You know, you don't realize till now as an adult, when you know, especially as me, when I'm writing this book, when you really watch him, that he essentially walked on his tippy toes all the time. The reason he spun around and did all the moves and didn't stand still was so that he could arch himself up a little bit taller to these guys, and that you know, he could take up more space. His, you know, when you talk to his designer of all his outfits, who has passed away, but I found a lot of interviews with him, the whole point of the cowboy hats and the tassels and all the colors was to take up more space, because at the end of the day, he did get up to 230, maybe even 240, you know, certain years. But he was not one of these giant Hulk Hogan, Big John Studd, Andre the Giant, you know, men who had been a big man their whole lives.
So how did the character take shape and become the winning combination for him, the Macho Man character?
Yeah, that was an evolution. You know, one of the themes of the book that I think people are kind of taking away is it's really very much a story of transformation. It's a story of perseverance. You know, it's adapting all the time. When baseball, you know, crapped out on him and he had to go into wrestling or wanted to go into wrestling, he realized that he was too small, so he gets bigger. Then when he gets bigger, at this point in time, he's wrestling with his brother and his dad, and he realizes that we have, you know, Randy Poffo and Lanny Poffo and Angelo Poffo. He wanted to, you know, break out in his own name, and they could do a lot more storytelling wise with Randy being a different person, people not knowing that he was his brother. But in order to do that, he had to kind of come up with a brand new persona and brand new character that really separated himself from A, his brother and his dad, but also anyone else out there, right? So his answer in the beginning was to kind of do the opposite of baseball. You know, minor league baseball players, especially back then, were just meant to get in line. They had, you know, clean shaven. They weren't allowed facial hair. They weren't allowed hair beneath their ears, even in the 70s. For the most part, for his organization. So he decided to do the opposite, right? The George Costanza opposite. He grew his hair long. He grew out his beard that we all know now. He started wearing, you know, he went through a variety of different types of outfits from, you know, like a George Carlin hipster, but all pumped up, to a biker type, to at one point he had a cowboy straw hat, you know, trying things that might register with the audience. And he began wrestling with, you know, a lot of pent up energy and frustration. And he was described by Ole Anderson early on as wrestling like a savage. And when he was thinking of a different name, that's where Savage came from.
So what made the connection to the fan base? He was eventually sort of courted by Vince McMahon with WWF at the time to make the jump to kind of a national figure. And it seems like from that point on, his career just really accelerated with audiences.
Yeah, he managed to do something that a lot of the other wrestlers couldn't do. He made you feel like you were a part. So when you were like, when you were a Hulkamaniac, and we all were at some point, if you grew up, you know, in the 80s and 90s watching wrestling, you were cheering for the Hulkster. Macho Man, it was like you were part of the madness. And it's a distinction because you could do the voice, you could do the moves, you could do the twitches. You know, Hulk was so big and so larger than life. He wasn't super athletic when it came to, you know, he obviously was for his size, but when it came to the in the ring stuff, his, you know, he had a clothesline, he had the leg drop, he had power, but Macho's moves you could kind of do yourself. I mean, you know, some of the best memories, a lot of the people that I've talked to, and even me growing up as a Macho Man fan, are, you know, you could lay your brother down on the couch or on a bed and like do your own elbow drop off the off your desk, right onto him. Like you could do Macho's moves. You could, you know, you could spin around and you could call the audience. And so I think his relatability, as crazy and unique and individual as he was, there was a level of relatability to him that I think is what got a lot of us involved. And the other part is just sheer charisma. Even next to the Hulkster, even next to Million Dollar Man and you know, Ricky Steamboat and Tito Santana and all these guys, from the very beginning, I grew up, the first guy that I liked when I was, you know, 5 or 6 was Big John Studd. I called myself Little John Studd. I was all into him. but they were sort of all lumbering big guys. The wrestlers of the 70s were known as that type of, you know, just giants. These were guys who were probably, you know, on their high school wrestling team, maybe wrestled in college, certainly on their high school football team, just guys who were that big man on campus type. And that wasn't Randy. So maybe we all felt a little bit of that or saw a little bit of that when he performed. And that is what, you know, really made us want to get on board.
Which brings up another point, and it's an important one, about his approach to this work. I mean, it's fair to say for most of these guys, it's work, it's a character. You know, they put the uniform on and they're a different person for the performance. But it almost seemed like for Randy Savage, he was like a method actor, and he was the guy a lot more than a lot of the other wrestlers of his era were.
Yeah, I spent so much time I spent so much time inside of his head, because that wasn't a place you wanted to really be for too long. But with a guy like Randy, it was past method acting. You know, even Lanny, his brother, who I was, you know, fortunate enough to interview for this book.
He ended up dying shortly after you two had worked very closely on the book, we should say.
Yeah. I had interviewed him. It took about a year to get in touch with him, which was really, really important for me to make sure I had him access to him as a source, and to kind of just have his opinion on a lot of the things that were going on, and to have inside and, you know, the inside stuff. What was your house like the day he didn't get drafted? What was it like to walk into an arena when your dad's getting booed? You know, the kinds of things that only Lanny could have answered. And, you know, when we think of Macho Man himself and Lanny himself, we think of how they were, you know, how they were raised. The hardest part to comprehend is that he created this character and then never left. And, you know, there's lines that there's a lot of wrestlers who say, I talked to even Paul Roma and all these guys. It's like when you wrestle and then, you know, you're at the airport, you're using, you know, jeans and a t-shirt, the, you know, baseball hat on, just kind of blending in. Macho wrestled and went to the airport and looked like Macho. You know what I mean? Like, there was no off switch. You know, one of my favorite interviews was with Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and he was like, yeah, you go to McDonald's at midnight after a show before you get on the plane or get on a tour bus. And it was, I'll have a large fry. And, you know, it was like, he'd just do the whole thing. And there was, you know, part of the issue with, you know, I think with him and Elizabeth was when the show would end, it wasn't as if Macho would be gone and Randy would appear. It was just Macho and then more Macho.
So Macho Man Randy Savage, you know, eventually he left wrestling behind, and in his later years, he had a much quieter existence. He died in a car crash in 2011. And I just wonder how you think about his legacy today. You know, with wrestling, obviously, the wins and losses don't count as much as sort of the imprint or the character. What do you think of Macho Man's sort of importance in the history of wrestling and the character that he embodied?
I think he is one of the most important transcendent wrestlers we've ever had. He is one of the only wrestlers who completely and totally crossed over into the mainstream. We've had recently, guys like The Rock and John Cena, to a certain extent, Stone Cold, but you can count, you know, on both hands, the number of wrestlers who that question of like, does your grandmom know who he is? Right. And part of that is because of Slim Jim, you know, when he went the height of the Slim Jim commercials, he was everywhere. He was at NFL games and NASCAR, you know, tracks and college games. And he was at every big event. He was like, you couldn't miss him. You could watch whatever sport you were watching back then, baseball games. It didn't matter. Randy Savage was a 12-month-a-year presence on your TV screen back when you couldn't skip commercials. So that certainly helped. But his unmistakable voice and look, his appearances on, you know, Arsenio and Regis and Kelly, back then, you know, Regis and Kathy Lee back then, like, he was as A-list apex mainstream as you could get from like 86 to maybe 94, 95, probably not 95, but about 6 or 7 years. And so that is his legacy. I mean, think about the best like perspective I have on it is I have it. My son's 11 years old. He was 9 when I started this book. He had been into wrestling a pretty good amount when I started, but then he got on board with all the stuff that we were doing. He watched all the WrestleManias with me. He watched all the, you know, old Piper's Pits on YouTube with Macho and everything we could find. He became a huge Macho Man fan. But when I first started, he just knew him from all the, you know, memes and, you know, gifs and stuff like that. And so it's like when this new generation only knows him as somebody that will send like the "ooh yeah" or "cream of the crop" as like on a text message, but then they realize he had this entire era almost to himself as far as catchphrases, and he was on the microphone. I mean, obviously he's top two or three, I think, him and probably The Rock, and pick whoever your third person is, as far as just cutting promos and being, you know, unable to take your eyes off, and also, you know, dropping those catchphrases that people like to repeat and just being so unique. And so I think
you know, they all people always talk about Mount Rushmores and all that stuff, and he's certainly on mine. But he is whatever list you're talking about when it comes to transcendent wrestling figures, he's on it.
Well, the name of the new book is Macho Man, The Untamed, Unbelievable Life of Randy Savage. And we've been speaking with author John Finkel. I'm, I think, right in that age sweet spot to have been captivated by him, even though I'm not a big wrestling fan. So thank you for writing the book. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.